Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And we are here, another edition of Pollock and Thurston, back on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. All is right in the world as we are live here to chat about the ongoing saga that is professional wrestling, the beat that we have so chosen to walk down. How are you, Brandon?
I'm good. It's just another day in the life of the wrestling journalist. What can you say?
Yes, yes. We are going to be talking about maybe the state of the wrestling journalist and where will they be spending their online social interactivity.
They should be reporting on things, where will they be quote tweeting people?
Where are we going to be having the most volume of discourse? Is there a shift in the balance, or is it just a mirage? All that to come on today's show. A bunch of topics that we will be handling. But number one, Brandon, just right away, we had an on-the-ground interaction between you and World Wrestling Entertainment this past Friday. Did you take the bike to the KeyBank Center? How did you transport yourself? And was this a last-minute decision? Because you seemed undecided when we spoke last Thursday.
It was a very much last-minute decision. So I did not ride my bike. My bike needs a tube replacement because I always leave it outside. Like a bad bike owner that I am. And so the cold weather comes or whatever, and it needs a tube replacement. So I have a flat tire. I decided at the very last minute to go. This is a great conversation we're going to have now. I drove to the very limited public transit that we have here in the Buffalo, New York region. And I went to the Metro Rail, one of the stations that goes underneath Main Street. I drove there. I got on the rail, which takes you downtown, but it only took you so far downtown because they're doing construction or something. So it doesn't take you all the way there. You have to get out where it would go above ground, and then you have to go get on a bus. You take a bus the rest of the way to the arena. And so I went to the arena, and I paid $40 or $50 for a ticket. I said, give me the cheapest ticket you've got. And they gave me the cheapest ticket they've got. And Chris, that's $1 million gate in Buffalo. I went to the arena, never sat in my seat. I walked around a bunch of times. I took some pictures, and then I got on the phone and did some reporting.
Now, by taking pictures, how many Pollock and Thurston fans stopped you?
I was wearing my WrestleNomics hat, so I was not very recognizable. Somebody did. Now I took the bus back home, and somebody did fist bump me out of the blue. I don't know if that was a listener. Hello, listener. If that was you, thank you for the fist bump. I was on the phone, so there couldn't be more conversation at that time.
I understood you were, you're a man in high demand at all hours of the day.
I spent most of the show in the stairwell. That's true.
You did do your best, Cochet Urbe. You got a very nice, kind of panoramic shot of the venue. And, you know, I think that all you need, I think for all of these photos where you go to the rafters.
Yeah.
I think you should always get that commemorative WrestleMania 3 shout out and get a guy at the balcony to put his fist in the air, like the guy from the famous shot. And I think I could link all of this together. Always fun to get an in-person interaction with a WWE event, even if it's from a stairwell. Did it sound like a hot company from the stairwell? Were the reactions penetrating the walls?
This was a stark contrast from when I went to Dynamite in the same building, and I wrote something about it. I thought maybe I would go and write something that I didn't have enough of an experience, but I mean, yes, it was packed. I remember going to a Raw some 8 years ago or so in the same building, and there were, you know, the 300 level was curtained off. This was not that. This was packed as can be. And from not watching the show, I can tell you it to that extent, it felt like a hot crowd. Yeah. And I did hear some pops while I was in the in the stairwell too. I was wondering, was The Rock there? Because The Rock was rumored to be in town all day, but no Rock, correct?
No, but we did have the Bloodline, the original Bloodline, all coming together. And there you go. The most famous man that I would love to talk to is the guy that might have been the older brother from the Goonies with his fist in the air as he is proclaiming, I am one of however many number you believe are in this venue.
Don't get into it. Don't say a number.
Okay. Are you aware that there is a book coming out by Keith Elliott Greenberg covering WrestleMania 3?
I might have heard that, but not really. That sounds about right. Yeah, sure.
Okay. That'll be a fun discussion. I think WrestleMania 3 attendance it's in proximity now of the Montreal Screwjob in terms of my just like melt me to the ground. I have nothing left in me to discuss on this topic.
Yeah. Same. I've done all the work that I've done a lot of work on WrestleMania 3.
You have led the charge.
Yeah. Let's not get into it. I don't want to talk about sensitive things. I'll talk about politics instead.
Let's move on to Linda McMahon. She of the America First Super PAC and one of the highest donors to the Trump reelection campaign. And this coming from Reuters several days ago. What is the first way to identify Linda McMahon after all of these millions poured into Republican politics, a role in Trump's cabinet on the previous administration, still identified by Reuters? Professional wrestling magnet. And former Small Business Administration Director Linda McMahon is seen as the front runner to lead Donald Trump's Department of Commerce. Three sources, Brandon, briefed on the plans set on Friday. McMahon is a major donor and was an early supporter of the Republican president-elect when he first ran for the White House almost a decade ago. This cycle, Trump tapped her to co-lead a transition team formed to help vet personnel and draft policy ahead of Tuesday's election. Given the early stages in the process, it was unclear whether she will ultimately get the job. Bit of an asterisk there at the end. Would not be surprised to see Linda McMahon with a prominent cabinet role in this next Trump administration, joining the likes of Vivek Ramaswamy and Elon Yes. Musk, who are already assuming prominent roles, creating new roles. We're going to have efficiency in the government. Sit back. This is going to be quite the ride. And Linda McMahon looks to have a front row seat.
Yes, she gave Donald Trump and his political action committees a lot of money, as she always does, $10 million to the Make America Great Again, Inc. PAC, hundreds of thousands of dollars to others, multiple millions to others. It's a lot of money. And, you know, people will say this is pay to play. So if you want to have a cabinet position, you better be as involved as you know, a good $10 million or so. To that PAC in particular that she gave $10 million to, she is the number two contributor, one of the two major PACs that she gives to. She was the number two contributor behind one Timothy Mellon, who is not to be outdone, some sort of bank heir who gave over $100 million to Trump.
You know, you turn your couch over, you're bound to come up with you know, eight, nine figures.
Money. Yeah.
I mean, that just, you know, it's pocket change. Linda McMahon is going to have, the influence is almost, it was almost like this interesting byproduct of Donald Trump's navigation into politics that you had a Linda McMahon, and that, as we learned during the pandemic, the people that he leaned on, including Vince McMahon and Dana White. And at this point now, it is almost bizarro world where, I mean, like the influence that has grown from the McMahons, from Dana White to Joe Rogan. This is just part and parcel of the political landscape at this stage of things. And I think naturally from the pro wrestling perspective, the look at Vince McMahon, and certainly someone that I think values a Trump administration much more than a Kamala Harris administration.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how close they really are. I have a feeling that Donald Trump is a fairly busy person. A lot of people vying for his attention. You did have a Vince McMahon spokesperson at the time follow up with that article in NBC, the infamous cats and dogs article about what he's doing with his spare time. He went to Italy. He's adopting cats or something with pets. And there was like a follow up. There was an update to that article where Vince McMahon's spokesperson wanted to clarify that something to the effect of Trump and Vince had not really been talking that often. I think she's probably, he's probably a lot closer to, Trump is probably a lot closer to Linda, I would say, than Vince. And who knows what the relationship is like between Vince and Linda at this point, but even if it's not good, you could still see Linda not wanting to her family to be associated with the allegations, including sex trafficking and sexual assault allegations that are alleged against Vince, that he is reportedly under investigation for with the Southern District of New York. And we're getting close to the timeout date on the civil lawsuit, which has been put on hold as time goes on here. Maybe
under 30 days, the 30 day countdown begins for this stay to come to an end,
which started in, I believe, May. Okay. May was the motion was in
right.
course.
And then the 6 months went into effect.
Yeah. So we're now on the fifth out of 6 months and no indictment yet.
Just revisiting, we spoke about Mark Shapiro's interview with CNBC last week, and a lot of focus, I think, naturally went to Mark Shapiro disclosing that he recently had breakfast with Vince McMahon. Did you, just giving it some thought, what do you believe of the, like, for this year and the amount of distance that TKO has placed between Vince McMahon? I am not surprised that a Mark Shapiro would meet with Vince McMahon, but being so voluntary to disclose that information, do you think that is, that there's anything to look into that, or is it just simply that this is, like, they are, it is largely not a controversy at this point to be disclosing that, hey, we're in contact with Vince McMahon, he's a shareholder, and that's that, and there's not going to be, if anything, they're kind of taking their foot off the gas when it comes to like the concern about having any kind of attachment to Vince McMahon that a whole lot of this
that,
year
that has been of a deal. I think Shapiro and Ari Emanuel, it's interesting to see them operate. I mean, we barely hear from Ari Emanuel on WWE to begin with, but so it's mostly Mark Shapiro who seems to be leading TKO, or that's being delegated to him. They're not clearly deeply ingrained in all of these wrestling compulsions that you must abide by because WWE did it. He clearly seems to me to be somebody who's much more familiar naturally with UFC than WWE. In any case, I guess what I'm getting at is I don't think that
he's also been the one that on like previous calls, like he has like brought up Vince's name. It's not like the name that you do not say. And that might be more of a kind of a WWE PR strategy, right? That when someone is distance, you don't speak of that person, you don't refer to that person. And in the real world, it's not as prevalent of a restriction.
He's not entrenched with decades of a wrestler leaving a company and then never mentioning that person again. What happened with Indy Hartwell this past week, for example, right? I think it's not overly concerning. I think if you're if you're maybe on Janelle Grant's side, maybe you point to that to say, look, they're still close with this guy. But I think it's probably not that big. I don't see it as like the beginning point of he's going to be coming back when all of his litigation is all done. I don't think he's going to be coming back regardless, because this was ultimately the Snickers doctrine was enacted here. And Slim Jim said, we don't want to be involved in this. So I think it's too risky to bring him back, not to mention, the fans are enjoying the content because he's not around. It is because he's not around, in my opinion, pretty clearly. He has no instrument like he did before to make his way back. He has about 5% of the stock. There's no way for him to come back without the support of basically Ari Emanuel. So I don't think it's
what happening. If they need a face to put behind PBR?
To put behind PBR. Maybe. I mean, I think even then, like, you wanted to have sponsors for PBR, right? I think he would be a sponsorship liability.
Well, so the plot thickens. But December 11th is when the pause ends, involving the federal investigation into Vince McMahon.
Something we should ask about too is like, if he's not indicted, he's not charged with anything, will we get a clear answer on that? Will we see maybe Vince's representatives call that out and say, yes, he is not going to be charged now? Will we get a clear, it's over now kind of message?
I think for the amount that Vince McMahon is paying for lawyers and having multiple PR firms that we've now been aware of that he has been through. I mean, he's no longer with Michael Citrick. He is now with Edendale Strategies. I think that's the entire investment into a PR firm is the public message at the end of this of exonerating Vince McMahon in the public forum. This is someone I obviously wants to continue to work, and this is preventing him from working. So yeah, I would think like there's going to be a huge victory lap for Vince McMahon to publicly put himself into a positive light, at least within the business community, that it is safe to do business with Vince McMahon. I think that would be the entire process that he would look to be going into.
Yes. No collusion, no obstruction, total exoneration. He will look for that message sometime in the future.
He beat the government 2-0 against the feds.
We'll see. We're not doing a moratorium here yet, but we'll see.
2-0. We're going to move on from Vince McMahon. Carlin Kolker, you did some reporting on the latest that Carlin Kolker made a filing, and we did get a response from Ann Callis. He is seeking the dismissal that had been presented, and we continue to get into this back and forth about the reveal of these medical records, and going back to July when Grant had filed the petition, and this was after allegedly earlier in the year trying to seek these full medical records, the full electronic medical records and metadata. So what can you tell us in plain English of where we stand in this continuing back and forth that does not include a lawsuit yet involving these parties?
No, this is a legal action, but it is in Connecticut State Court. It is a what we will call a petition or a bill of discovery. So this is for background information. If you don't already know, Dr. Kolker is this doctor at a clinic called Peak Wellness in Greenwich, Connecticut. Vince McMahon, according to Janelle Grant, Vince McMahon sent Janelle Grant to seek treatment for anxiety, among other things, at this clinic where she was given supplements, pills, IV infusions. She was not told what she was being given, according to her. And she's demanding medical records, among other things. And so what apparently happened here, what we've learned here that's new, is that that Peak Wellness, the lawyers for the defendants here, which are Peak Wellness and Dr. Kolker, they have given her medical records and billing records. They say in February and March, Grant had asked for those records and they got paper copies. Grant is asking for the records in electronic form, particularly including metadata. Unclear if metadata was transferred here, but that would, I guess if you have metadata, that would support the notion that these are legitimate, authentic medical records that have not been changed in some way. But we do have email exhibits in the latest filing that show lawyers for Kolker giving these records to lawyers for Grant. So that's not everything that Grant is asking for. There's a whole list of things that she wants, including any communications between Vince McMahon and Dr. Kolker. But they are showing, hey, look, we've got emails. We don't see what the attachments are. Of course, we're not seeing her medical records, but we are seeing an email that appears to have a PDF attached to it. And then we do have an acknowledgement of receipt on one of the emails in response from Grant's representatives.
And so are these eight categories, I mean, is this stuff they are still seeking, or was this from the get-go of what they have requested and there is aspects to this they have received versus not received? Do we have any clarity on that? Because there's some like basic stuff here, like the substance that she was prescribed. Like I would think that is at a very base level. She should be aware of by now.
You would think that would be in the medical records if they have now received the medical records. But we did get a comment from Ann Callis, who is Janelle Grant's attorney, who says, by his own admission, Dr. Kolker's filing today, all but, and this is last week, all but confirms they have withheld the requested records for fear they could lead to further legal action against him. Ms. Grant deserves answers, and we respectfully ask the court to compel Dr. Kolker and Peak Wellness to provide her with long overdue clarity, which sort of contradicts the notion that they have been given records. They are seeking all this information. Basically, this could lead to a lawsuit, probably in federal court. The legal argument that Kolker's side is raising is that, look, Grant's side is not trying to sue us in this state court, and this state action to get records and to get communication records from us is not an appropriate way to administer the law. This is only for if you're going to sue somebody in this state court, Connecticut Superior Court, as opposed to federal court. It's possible also that they could end up being added as defendants on the high profile federal lawsuit, which involves W. Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis. That seems like a possible outcome here is what they're trying to do to add them as defendants on the big federal case.
You earned a degree in the behavioral health field because you wanted to make a difference. And you're needed now more than ever. Through the new Great Minds Fellowship Program, recent Ohio graduates may be able to receive as much as $20,000 in student loan support when working full-time at a community behavioral health center. Apply before November 15th. To learn more about program eligibility, visit highered.ohio.gov. That's highered.ohio.gov.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we are bringing you two editions of Rewind Away, starting off with a film review of Death Warrior. As described, the 2009 classic features five of the best mixed martial arts champions from around the world forced to play a deadly game. Plus, we tackle TNA's turning point from 2009. Karen Peterson and Bruce Lord will be covering the historic Crossover 2 event, plus an Ask Away mailbag show, Rewind to SmackDown, and Collision Course. $6 a month gets you access to the Post Wrestling Cafe.
Last week, we had several WWE cuts to, Baron Corbin, whose contract is not being renewed.
Careful. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't bring that up to Paul Levesque and say that he was cut. He was just told, as of this date, you no longer work here, but that's not being cut. So Baron Corbin, not being renewed, and then actual cuts to Tegan Nox and Indy Hartwell. So Indy Hartwell, who was right in the midst of a storyline involving Nia Jax and Candice LeRae and was not there in Buffalo on Friday night. So yeah, but Candice LeRae coming out and pretty much doing her entrance and referring to Indy Hartwell, putting her hand up, but no one to meet her. So it's an interesting look at especially someone like a Baron Corbin of where we stand today when it comes to when these talents become available, what the market is outside of WWE. I think for a Tegan Nox and Indy Hartwell, you're talking about people who are not even in their 30s yet. But a Baron Corbin's always an interesting example of someone. He is 40. He has only existed in pro wrestling in WWE's system since 2012 when, you know, he had left football to pursue professional wrestling. And he's obviously had several big years. He's been on the main roster for 8 years, and I think that's more an interesting one is where you take someone from this WWE system and how they continue a career in pro wrestling, if at all. Like, this is kind of a crossroads moment. But do you see this as a talent-friendly market at this point when someone becomes available?
For these three, I think they could all get work and continue to have a career as pro wrestlers if they wanted to. It seems more likely for Indy Hartwell and for Tegan Nox, Nixon Newell. Maybe less likely for Baron Corbin because he's older and because wasn't it him who said, like, once I'm done with WWE, I'll hang my boots up forever. I think there would be a great indie run, though, for Baron Corbin to be like the anti-indie guy. I think that would be great. I remember, you know, just loving it when he was like yelling at Apollo Crews for going back. You should go back to the small halls, go back and wrestle for Ring of Honor. Apollo Crews never wrestled for Ring of Honor. I think it would be great.
I think that there is, I think that Baron Corbin, I think people did come around on Baron Corbin because I would say that period of like 2018 and 2019, I mean, he was as attached to like dismal WWE creative as there was in terms of an on-screen representation. And I think that is, you know, something that you can certainly channel, at least short-term, outside of WWE. And I think it comes down to someone like him that, you know, it's making that adjustment. You are, I would say, today's version of AEW, I don't disqualify someone coming off WWE television with a Baron Corbin. I would have at another point, but not today. But that's probably the only place that you can make anywhere in the ballpark of the money that a WWE could provide. It is quite a several notches down if you want to continue this and going from a WWE to Game Changer Wrestling.
Yeah, I imagine he made a good living, especially considering the number of years that he worked on the main roster and considering this is relative place on the card. I mean, he had big matches with Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins, so he's probably making a decent living. But does he want to
kind of had an online like the influencer lane that he was getting into, like when it comes to like you know, just the videos and stuff that he was putting out there? Like I'm certain he was making some coin just, you know, cooking steaks and such. I would always see this guy pop.
Was he doing sponsored like Instagram videos or something?
Oh, he had like knives that he was promoting and just different like
he could continue to do that. Yeah,
might be. Listen, if you can stay at home and make a good amount, absolutely
make steaks. Yeah.
Go the influencer route. That could be his calling. This coming Friday, Brandon, will you be logging into Netflix for Mike Tyson, Jake Paul from AT&T Stadium, and will we find a Turnstile account for Tyson, Jake Paul?
I bet you can. I bet you could. The Arlington police like to give that information up if you just ask nicely. I don't know that I'll watch it. Didn't know it was this Friday. Knew it was coming up, though.
Well, that's a bad signal then if it hasn't reached your radar yet. It's a very important event for Netflix itself. I don't think that this is... I don't know if this is really going to... create this demand for more boxing on Netflix, because I think there's only so many of these types of fights, and this is probably the high end of that, where you have a Mike Tyson at 58 that is going to fight, where there is such a freak show attraction to this that like Jake Paul has done a wonderful job of marketing himself, and that flies in the face of all of the like the performances of a lot of these pay-per-views, that it's almost like this belief that he is this gigantic draw on pay-per-view. And this is sort of the attraction of fighting somebody that really does bring that level of cachet in a Mike Tyson.
Who's favorite to win this fight?
I think that Jake Paul is the favorite in this
fight. Mike Tyson is 58 years old. Jake Paul's what, in his early 30s or something? Late 20s?
I don't think he's even 30. He might be 27.
He is 27.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's going to be a spectacle, and these are the types of spectacles Netflix is going after. I don't think they want to be doing just any regurgitated boxing
cards. Jake Paul's a 210 favorite.
Okay. Well, I think that that's probably the fair assumption here. It's two-minute rounds is what they're going to be competing at. So this is, they're not even doing the full 3-minute rounds here. I mean, this could be, there's a novelty to seeing what will happen. It's a total spectacle. Could be a total disaster in terms of what this turns into. But I think there's going to be a ton of attention. Like, this will be, just because of the availability of Netflix, this is going to be one of the most watched fights ever, when you take down the restrictions of, you know, a $60 price tag, and it's available to anyone with a Netflix account.
Will we know how many people have watched it after it happens?
That's a good question. Is this going to populate on the top 10? Will we be able to get a breakdown?
I would think so. I would think it'll go in the top 10. Yeah.
I mean, this is one where it's going to be very concentrated to probably a 48-hour period. I don't think there's going to be too many people going back a week later to watch this. But it was interesting this week. I was curious watching like Raw if WWE was going to have any sort of promotion for this fight going into Friday, but nothing, no cross promotion for their future partners in Netflix. Which, by the way, I did. I've been looking into this. So in Canada, all WWE programming moves to Netflix in the new year, and originally Netflix, they've already got the first episode listings on Netflix for Raw, SmackDown, and NXT. And they were promoting the first event on Netflix to be the January 3rd SmackDown. They have since updated that. Now it is the January 10th SmackDown. So there's all this concern, Brandon. What's going to happen to that SmackDown on January 3rd? And I did confirm with Sportsnet, they will cease programming as of December 31st of WWE. So I don't know if this January 3rd show is going to air on Netflix.
Maybe it'll just be a best of show or something. It sounds like maybe they want to have the first event be
I think they want the Raw to be the big kickoff.
That is in the U.S. as well, yeah.
But it is a new SmackDown on January 3rd. I did, like, they do have a SmackDown event.
They have a live event date for it?
January 3rd, they're in Phoenix for a SmackDown.
Okay.
So I don't know. Sportsnet, as far as I can tell, is not going to be airing that January 3rd show. But we will.
Well, someone needs to ask NBC Universal if they're going to be airing. Of course they will be. Okay. So there'll still be.
They will.
This
is only a Canadian issue. Yeah.
Okay.
You will be safe. Okay. Maybe I'll have to drive to Buffalo to watch that night SmackDown. I mean,
what can we do? If the VPN isn't working, we're here.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the old school way, across the border. So anyway, that's on the Netflix front. I think it's going to be a very, very noteworthy event this Friday to see how big of a cultural event this is. Mike Tyson fighting.
Along the lines of Netflix, should we talk about potential Raw ratings on Netflix?
Yes. You have been looking for how are we going to find this out? And you do have some information for us.
Yeah. So there was an article that came out. I saw it on Front Office Sports. I assume it's with a lot of other outlets as well, that Nielsen is going to be covering the NFL Christmas Day games on Netflix. But we do have this information here. It's coming from Synopsis as well as others. On the measurement front, Netflix has partnered with VideoAmp in the U.S. to deliver advertisers cross-screen and live viewership measurement, both of which will start with WWE's launch in January and partnered with Nielsen for live ratings of Christmas Day games of the NFL. So there's going to be – now, I don't think that this means, like, I'm going to get – maybe I will. I don't know. But I think this is basically for advertisers. This is like, okay, we have some third party here who's going to give advertisers data, so you're not just having to rely on first-party data if you're buying advertising during Raw or some other Netflix programming. This VideoAmp is also, I understand, working with CBS because CBS is in like a standoff with Nielsen. But Nielsen is still, I mean, we're still getting ratings for like what Survivor is doing and stuff like that. So Nielsen is still measuring that. So we'll see what happens. And if nothing else, so if there's no data that comes directly out of this, or if Nielsen doesn't eventually cover things like Raw as well, if nothing else, we're still going to have this top 10 list that I would think, Raw would make it into, because what's in the top 10? I mean, the bottom of the top 10 for the most recent week is 2 million. Now, remember, this is a global number. They will not give us similar numbers for the U.S. for us to compare region like to like with the numbers that we're more familiar with, where Raw does between 1.4 and 1.7 million viewers or something like that in that range. But this will be a global number. So I would assume that, let's say in the U.S., it's going to do maybe something at least kind of in the neighborhood of what it usually does on the USA Network. So you consider that on top of the fact that this is going to be basically live plus some 6 days of delayed viewing, plus not just the U.S., but everywhere else around the world that it's going to be airing, including Canada, the U.K., Ireland. I believe Latin America it'll be on quickly. I'm not sure about the timing for India, but I would think it's going to have enough distribution regionally that it's going to meet this 2 million. If assuming this is like a normal, when we can cycle through, I suppose here. Yeah. 2 million, 2.1 million the week before, 2.2 million the week before, 2 million. I would think it's going to be over 2 million on the regular. So that would tell us that we're going to get this sort of global rating number that Netflix might give us through their first party data here.
Well, I look forward to this. This is a great development.
So you will not be escaping. I saw people quote tweeting trying to celebrate. You will not be escaping Raw ratings discourse. It's not going to happen.
Brandon's coming for you. Okay. No matter what platform you're on, more of that to come. Let's talk about this discussion that came out of last week's Lightshed podcast, because when it comes to pay-per-view models, Brandon Ross, former guest on the show, friend of the show, was discussing on the podcast with Rich Greenfield about last week's TKO call and Brandon's thoughts about UFC and whether it should go in the direction WWE has done regarding its pay-per-view content.
TKO should think about moving UFC away from the pay-per-view model onto a platform, putting their best content onto a platform like Netflix, where it is going to get maximum reach and build the brand bigger than it is now. Right now, how many people in the United States are paying? How many pay-per-view buys are there? I think that, I don't know if it's, 12 a year, but I do believe that a subset of the best content should be more widely available. And I asked that on the call. The answer seemed to be that they would do whatever, you know, brought in the most dollars. That's kind of where the focus is. I think it's slightly myopic, but by the way, I'm not saying Netflix. I know the question at hand here is Netflix, and that was the question that was posed to Shapiro, but it could be Amazon.
Right. You're thinking more broadly of, could this be included in a subscription service?
At least part of it.
Correct. I think Amazon makes a ton of sense.
So there you go. Brandon Ross and Rich Greenfield. That's probably the best way to hear Brandon Ross on this show, because wrestling Twitter, I think, scared him off of Pollock and Thurston.
I don't know if we'll come back
for at least a couple of months before we'll have the courage to ask him to come back on. He was a brave soul last time. But I don't think I'm going to be stunned to hear your response, Brandon, because you have really beat the drum on this, the impact that WWE had by with the advent of the network, and then even more so with Peacock, your most valuable content reaching the most amount of people. It has coincided with WWE popularity growth, and with UFC, it's an incomplete analysis to give, because we just don't get any insight into what these pay-per-views are doing month to month on ESPN Plus.
The biggest ones are probably still capable of doing 1 million buys, you think?
I would say those are the
that's the peak, and then the
aberration.
Norms, median is probably multiple hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is similar to WWE in the tail end of their pay per view history. I'm a firm believer in that. WWE's content was not good in the mid 2010s. It was on the decline of popularity, but 2014, 2015, that stabilized and in fact went up in part because of, maybe because of some new talent getting elevated. You could look at the Shield, but in part because of distribution. And basically, I look at the formula of WrestleMomics being you've got a Y-axis that is star power. You've got an X-axis that is distribution. And without television, without star power, you don't have wrestling economics. But if you, what the W Network did is you're saying there is it opened up the most valuable content, the most interesting content you're building up to the pay-per-views, and it put it in front of hundreds of thousands of more people. And I think that caused people to downstream engage. The introduction, the availability of the library for the first time for the first several years, I think was a real value too, that caused people to have this downstream re-engagement with wrestling. I'm kind of caught up in that. So maybe I'm projecting my own experience on that a bit. But I think then we saw it again in 2021 when, for a number of years, like 2017, and then popularity went down. You see this in ticket sales and TV ratings and merchandise sales. It goes down and down and down. And then you have in 2020, things get a little hairy because you've got the COVID and the crowds going away. But when that same content goes from the W Network to Peacock, it went from being in the U.S. in front of 1.1, 1.2 million homes to being in front of or available to some 15, 20, 25, 30 now million homes. And not that it multiplied to the same degree, but it did increase the reach and according to their percentage differences that they would celebrate after every pay-per-view, including Crown Jewel most recently, it led to more people watching this peak content. Is it a good idea for UFC to do this? I don't know UFC well enough to say, but it would have at least that gross benefit of that. Maybe this is a way to grow the popularity of the sport, because you would be, and you have sort of the counterexample is boxing, right? Boxing in the pay-per-view era started to fall off. And I can't tell you who the most famous boxers are, who the top high profile boxers are, because it's basically been a pay-per-view business for most of my living memory.
Do you think that once you go this direction, such as WWE has, is it impossible to go back? And I'll use the,
right.
Of all the scenarios,
there's no going back, I think. Yeah.
Even for a WrestleMania, for instance, there would just be once the toothpaste is out of the tube, it's just your audience is not going to there's just going to be such friction to try and go back to a model where suddenly you are being asked to spend $60 for two nights of WrestleMania, for instance.
And you have the counterexample of AEW has calculated. Now, there might be a reason for this, but AEW at least has calculated, or their partners have, that the best way to monetize that is still going to be pay-per-view in this new deal. We expect, yes, it's going to, the pay-per-view is going to be on Max, but they're going to be on Max behind a one-time a la carte pay-per-view purchase. Now, maybe
which is the UFC model, basically, with ESPN Plus.
You have to be a subscriber, and then you get
opportunity to spend $80. Yes.
Yes. They say it'll be at a discount, though, of course, compared to other carriers. In any case, and maybe it's just the fact that, well, AEW, with its smaller audience, it's in a more of a niche. So maybe it makes sense that because of that, and because you've just got a harder core base of people, you don't have as much mass appeal as you do in the case of WWE, as you would in the case of UFC. I mean, I don't have a clear answer on like what the right thing is to do for UFC. I guess I now think in hindsight that it was a good idea to at least go on Peacock. I think WWE probably made a little bit less money being on the W Network versus being on pay-per-view, considering all of the startup costs, but it had the sort of indirect downstream effects that helps them. But yeah, it's, as you said, the big bet, the gamble is that you can't go back. You can't, you know, you either got to go all in and do it forever for the foreseeable future and blow away this successful business model.
Now, if you get into the mind of a Netflix, like let us assume that a year from now, Netflix looks at this WWE agreement with Raw. It's been a big hit. We're going to go all in on the pay-per-view content. Do you think that there is enough of a differentiating factor that you would
You're talking about WWE's pay-per-view content.
WWE's pay-per-view content.
The Peacock rights.
With Peacock. That having UFC and WWE is there too much, if we're getting one, is there that different of an audience? Like, would you see them wanting all
Absolutely,
of this?
It's a different audience. Yeah, I think there's very little overlap in these two audiences. I think I think we're in the Dana White camp there.
So the idea of Netflix going after both is
even if they are the same audience, you're talking about two different purchases. You're talking if they're both the same people, they're involved.
Assuming it's pay per view on Netflix and not like we're getting with this Tyson Paul fight on Friday.
You're talking about WWE going back to pay per view.
I'm talking about. If their pay-per-view rights just go to Netflix and all you need is a subscription to watch WWE content.
Right. Then what? What's the question?
The question just would be that if you're already getting this one TKO property,
right,
would it be as enticing to also go after the UFC product? Like, it's enough that there's a differentiation versus we're just going to put all of our eggs into the WWE basket and let an Amazon go after UFC.
I think there's very little overlap in those two audiences, and you're getting two different audiences by buying those two sets of rights.
Support for this Post Wrestling Podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chalk Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from Post Wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chop-tees.com/postwrestling.
WWE has announced they will be bringing Elimination Chamber to Toronto Saturday, March the 1st, but it's not going to be at the Scotiabank Arena, which is the usual stop for WWE here in the city. Instead, they are going to be running the Rogers Centre, the first time that they have booked the Rogers Centre, formerly SkyDome, still referred to as such by many Torontonians, since WrestleMania 18 in 2002. They made this announcement not in partnership with any local entity that is helping bring WWE to Toronto. So that would indicate to me that there is no site fee involved here, although we have yet to confirm if there's any kickbacks here. But yes, they are opting to run a stadium for Elimination Chamber, and you would think that they could probably top this out at 55,000 to 60,000 people based on configuration, which would see even in a hot period. I think that's a very ambitious total to aim for Elimination Chamber. But they certainly have believed they've outgrown the Scotiabank Arena by this booking.
And you'll have the farewell Cena tour, I think, by then.
Yeah.
Was Elimination Chamber one of the ones that he named? I think he named Elimination Chamber as one of the pay-per-views that he's doing, in addition to Royal Rumble and WrestleMania. So I would expect lean towards
six. Not just Elimination Chamber, John Cena's final Elimination Chamber. It's going to be his final everything next year.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So you'll have that, and maybe they'll do something with Canadians in a high-profile match or something like that. I think it's quite possible they'll do a good 40,000, if not pack this thing at high ticket prices too. I'm sure they're trying to extract here, although they've got a lot of volume and that could, you know, increase the supply and lower the price. I think they'll do pretty well here, but I agree. It looks like no site fee here, at least according to the press release. Doesn't mention something like I'm searching here to see what you have over there. The Toronto Sports Council would maybe be a potential partner if there were, but I don't see anything like that here yet.
Brought to you by Carl DeMarco and friends.
Carl DeMarco, yeah, what's he up to?
It's a good question. I should do an update on Carl DeMarco. It's been a while. But yes, that will be on March the 1st. Brandon Thurston crossing the border to be determined. We'll see if this one brings him over.
I'll turn off my Twitter before then.
Yes, I will be. I will plan to attend this. Cannot promise I will be staying till the end of this, but that's a separate discussion. NXT will also be going back on the road again next month. They're going to the famed Lowell Memorial Auditorium on December the 17th. So this will presumably be the last NXT of the year, because I'm sure they're not running Christmas Eve nor New Year's.
This is just a TV taping, right? This is not a PLE.
This is just a Tuesday night NXT taping on the road at the size of building that I would look at to be booking for an NXT.
Are they going to announce John Cena for this? What's the deal?
John Cena's last Lowell Memorial Auditorium appearance. I mean, that could be the hook for this last one. I am certain that some main roster performer will find his way onto the show, as NXT is typical to do in this type of promotion. And worth noting that was it AEW that just ran this building? Am I wrong? I could be. There was something recently in Lowell. Anyway, that's December the 17th as they wind down their year.
And they ran NXT Battleground in 2023 May. I don't see anything else jumping out as Lowell, Massachusetts.
So then we have the Ted Turner documentary series that has just launched today on Max.
It's out now.
It's out as of this morning. I did confirm through our requisite media correspondent, John Cena. All six episodes are up there.
Is there any wrestling references whatsoever?
So I watched the trailer, and that's all I can tell you, is that the trailer had no specific mentions of pro wrestling. I would be stunned if there is more than 30 seconds of pro wrestling covered in these six episodes. I think it will be a watershed moment for many pro wrestling fans to realize how little wrestling occupied this man's day to day. But still, an extremely influential figure when it comes to
and Hall of Fame wrestling. Candidate in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame.
Ended up getting my vote last week. So
this is the first time you vote for him?
I think it is. I don't think I voted for Ted Turner in the past. I've not been as strong on Ted Turner as others have been, but I felt I read a book on him this past year, and it's just with all the influence. To me, there is a difference between a Ted Turner versus a Bonnie Hammer, for instance, that I think Ted Turner is someone that very much did shape the industry from 1972 onward, and it's a drastically different industry. If you take out WTBS and Ted, like Nitro not being greenlit, is a monumental shift in the industry. And I can understand the pushback too, that this was not the guy that was running WCW day to day.
That was Eric Bischoff.
This was, like, if anything, this was a hobby horse for him that he assigned people to run. But he was the one underwriting it.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll check the series out at any point? Or is it really not?
Probably not anytime soon. But we don't know if there's any wrestling content in here whatsoever, right? We don't know yet.
No. I don't know. If there's a still shot of Ole Anderson, I will consider this a pro wrestling documentary for award season. But that remains to be seen. We do know ex-wife Jane Fonda interviewed for this. And this looks to be a very celebratory look at Ted Turner. Yes. Over.
And Ted is still alive. I understand he has... It was reported that he has dementia some years ago.
Lewy body dementia is what he is suffering from. And in the trailer, even though the description is that here Ted Turner is, in his own words, it at least based on the trailer, is not like he was interviewed for this.
Or something. Yeah,
probably. Yeah. So I don't think he's in any physical health to be doing interviews at this point. But I think turned either 85 or 86 this week. It coincided with his birthday. So there you have it. Ted Turner.
85. He turns 86 on the 19th.
Okay, on the 19th. All right, coming up this weekend then. Final topic. I almost called you Way by mistake. My brain is just mush at this particular day on Wednesday. But we are looking at the big divide. I'm not talking red states, blue states. I'm not talking AEW, WWE. We're talking about the next, the alternative to the dominant industry player. We're talking about Blue Sky, who have had quite the week, Brandon. They have added several million users this week, and they are hot on the heels of X, formerly known as Twitter, Post Wrestling and WrestleNomics, making the jump. Huge site fee that both of our brands respectively received from Blue Sky to pitch our flag into the surface and move on over. Do you look at Blue Sky as something that is going to be a relevant topic that we're talking about 6 months from now, or is this going to go the way of so many attempts at going after Twitter to create an alternative social media discussion platform?
I don't know. I think it will wear off over time, but we'll see. I think.
Well, what's your experience been like in the 24, 48 hours that you've been on
Blue Sky? I have been actually using Blue Sky. I don't think I had an account. I know people had to give me invites a long time ago, but I had not gotten on there. Luckily, the whole handle was for both WrestleNomics and Brandon Thurston were both available. So I'm on there. I'm on Threads. I spent a lot of time today and yesterday setting up APIs so that we will now be sharing. This is not started yet, but I think they tested okay this morning. We will now be sharing all of our website links on the WrestleNomics handles for both Blue Sky and Threads, as well as, of course, as always, Twitter, X. I think as time goes, I worry that we're going to end up in an even more bifurcated or fragmented media ecosystem, where not only are we polarized by what media content we consume, but even the media itself, the platform itself, will just be completely siloed, which is probably not a good thing for society.
I certainly see that. Like, that is kind of
that's the trajectory that we're on here.
It is the trajectory we're on, and it is the calling card of what a Blue Sky or a Threads are. It's like, the biggest selling feature is we're not Twitter. We're not this place. And I think you have Truth Social, you have Blue Sky, and then you kind of have this X in the middle that I don't see people necessarily eliminating their X accounts, because I thus far, 2 days into using Blue Sky, I mean, just throw out the discourse or whatever. Like, the functionality to me is really seamless. It's a very easy to use platform.
And this is Jack Dorsey's, the Twitter founder's platform, I understand.
Yes. I just, in terms of engagement, I mean, that to me was one thing on Threads, was just, it just felt like it was.
He has quit the board, I should add.
Oh, he's already given up. Maybe he saw something we haven't yet. But yes. Yeah, I jumped on Threads, and like, I'm always open to seeing how these new platforms work. But I think there's always the momentum at the beginning for these, and just time after time, everyone migrates back to Twitter, or they just disengage completely. It's not as though I think a ton of people are necessarily looking for an alternative. It's just being worn out by the addiction of being.
We've all lost a ton of followers in the last week or two. Have you noticed? I've checked Social Blade, which you can look up anybody's followers, and it's across the board. At least among people in wrestling who I have, I'm like my little list to see who's who my peers are gaining or losing followers. We've all lost it, depending on what scale you're at, tens, dozens, or hundreds of followers. As I don't know if it's just people leaving. I have no insight if it's bots. The bots are no longer useful now that the election is over. But it's less users, fewer users.
Yeah, I haven't noticed that myself on my account. It is going to be, I think, very interesting to see how much how many people move over to Blue Sky, and ultimately, I mean, what is and the measures in place that Blue Sky is utilizing to becomes very difficult when you're just we're going to eliminate like all of these negative attributes of X and how that's not going to permeate onto another social platform as you continue to add millions and millions of users. Or to your point, is this just becoming like we're going to be so siloed that we have no comprehension of alternative points of view, that people we disagree with, rather than engage, it's just going to be disengage, and it's going to become echo chambers for either side.
Yeah, I'm really not optimistic about the future in that regard. I think I don't know that the solution is to like engage, though, because engaging just leads to, you know, leads to heels being dug in. And I think just the you know, there's enough people, or maybe the typical person is, you know, not open-minded enough to have their minds changed. So you could engage and become more convinced of what you already believe, or you could become siloed and in an echo chamber and become more convinced of what you already believe. I just think we're on a trajectory to become even more polarized, radicalized, sure of ourselves. It's not a good thing.
Or at least this, well, I'm just stating, like, it's wild to me that it's like, this is not a platform. This is not a medium online that is built for, I think, constructive discussion. It can be, it'd be nice if it would be, but I mean,
I think the quote tweet was a real turning point too. I mean, I don't think enough people talk about this. Like the quote tweet coming out in 2015 or whatever it was, we now have this pillory tool, and I know it's used for other things, but it really enhances your ability to engage in call out culture, in dunk culture, and to say, look at this stupid person here. Look at what they did and said.
Combination of the quote tweet and the like count, because that is the video gamification of it all, yeah, too. It's a game that how hard you go at somebody and get the best zinger in, there's a score attached to it on top of it. And it takes out any level of, I think, rational discussion you can have with people, and ask yourself of how many arguments you've had with people online in the last 30 days, and how many in-person arguments you've had with human beings in the last year.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen. Like most sane people are not screaming at you walking down the street because of something you're wearing or just some disagreement. It's wild to me, but that is the online culture, and that's not ever changing. So I don't.
Sometimes
know
I just walk past strangers when I'm out in public. I walk past strangers as they walk past me. I think maybe that's the person who sends me angry DMs. You know, and I try to imagine that. But then just speak to the difference that the way that people behave in online life and in real life. I think we're all kind of drunk online. It's basically the same thing as being drunk. Now, I don't drink at all anymore, but I think it's the same sort of effects and the lowering of inhibitions and the ambitiousness of putting forth some idea. I think you got to kind of approach being online with the assumption that everyone that you're interacting with is rip roaring drunk. And if you get drunk and use social media, look at Jake Hager's feed on election night.
I don't follow Jake Hager, so I can't speak to it.
I don't know if he was drunk or not, but he was opinionated.
What is your reason, strictly as a reporter? What is your reason for maintaining a presence on X and also experimenting with others like Threads and Blue Sky?
I mean, here's the thing. Like I wouldn't have any of this, I think, without Twitter, right? And there's all these negatives about Twitter, but nobody cares who I am without Twitter or some similar tool.
No one cares about me with Twitter. So that's a change for me.
You had a life in this before Twitter. And mine was largely grown through Twitter. Now I didn't directly, other than the Elon pennies that he sends me once in a while for my tweets. I haven't made much money directly from it, but the money that I have made, I mean, the following that I've built and the Patreon that we've built largely because of it indirectly, that's a huge part of that is because of Twitter. But I think it's important still to me to distribute the content the distribute reporting. And I'll continue to do that on Twitter. If people use Blue Sky, well, it's going to be on Blue Sky also. If people use Threads, it'll be on Threads as well. But I think it's important to gain and sustain an audience.
That's where I'm at. And that's where I'm at for a lot of these. I mean, I think I disengaged on like just replying and having any kind of interactions on Twitter like a long time ago. I mean, I literally click on my mentions once or twice a year. I just don't read mentions. And to be honest, I feel like Twitter is not this like horrendous waste dump for me, because I don't give it a whole lot of my day either. And that hurts me too. I think I would benefit by being constantly online and engaging with people and building a profile for myself. But I think it would also just, it would drain so much of me that that transaction is not worth it for me. And yes, I'm fine having a much lower profile and kind of being disengaged from various platforms.
I don't know that it would benefit you that much by engaging with it more. Like, I don't want to see John Pollock quote tweeting people all day and yelling at them. I don't think that would be good for your brand.
You don't want to yell at eggs all day?
No.
Well,
no.
Anyway, I think it's interesting to hear. And again, I literally signed up for it because I got a text message from Wei telling me I should look into this. So I do what Wei tells me, and thus far I've enjoyed the functionality of it, the process. It seems to be worth my time to check in. And quite honestly, cross posting things, I've experienced a lot more engagement on Blue Sky than I have on X.
I'm going to follow you right now. There we go.
Oh, look at that. I didn't even have a Brandon Thurston.
I think I'm on the WrestleNomics account right now. So now the WrestleNomics account follows you. I think I was already following you from the other one.
Yeah, you might notice that follows you already. John Pollock was already on top of WrestleNomics. But for Twitter, who has, the millions and the hundreds of millions of users, I think I heard Blue Sky is at like 15 million users. Like, it's a fraction of a fraction. And the engagement to me is... It's a lot more than Threads, because Threads, I felt like I was just writing into the abyss, and there was just, I just don't think Threads was enough to keep bringing you back to the platform. And that's ultimately what's going to be the challenge for any competitor to X, because it seems that until proven otherwise, Twitter is going to be the town square for everyone, and they're not looking for multiple places to park their attention online.
No, it's not convenient for it to be aggregated everywhere. Maybe it'll be certain communities that are more that are on one than not the others. But it's not convenient, and it's I don't know. We'll see what happens if wrestling goes over there more. But I think it's really hard to overcome the almost 20 years, right? When did Twitter launch? In like 2006 or something like that. I first started to hear about it around was the Arab Spring in 2011, where it became more in the mainstream consciousness. So, I mean, that alone, if we only start the clock in 2011, that's some 13 years. And it's just really hard to overcome that time that Twitter has had to gain all these followers, even though the platform has changed a lot in terms of the paid blue check and everybody getting more attention. If you have the paid blue check, and in the divisiveness of Elon Musk. But yeah, it's kind of a 4chan board now, I guess is basically what it's become, but it's going to be really hard for all of that time, that land grab of time, sort of a Vince McMahon term. Remember the land grab, that's why they got into social early. And I mean, look, that's the early player. And it's going to be really hard. And TikTok has come along and it's exploded into popularity in recent years. But this is just the same. TikTok is a different thing, right? It's the short form video content. These are the same platforms, essentially, with slightly different settings and slightly different options. This is just text-based microblogging.
And it will normalize over time in terms of, I think, all the positives and negatives. I think they will even themselves out when you add volume, when you add the amount of user bases. I think right. These will start to reflect each other a lot more closely than upon first, the beta stages that we're kind of in.
Yes.
Are you ready for a question before we sign off?
Okay.
All right. Let us Super chat here. You've voiced frustrations about the lack of access to TKO, but besides complaining, what tactics have you taken as journalists, capital J, to further the reporter-subject relationship with TKO and WWE for coverage? First of all, Brandon, do you view having a frayed relationship with TKO, WWE yourself?
I think I have a respectful relationship with WWE.
I would classify the same. I don't look at it as necessarily a bad relationship or maybe,
what access are we looking for here? I'm all I think that we've argued is that it's okay to ask certain questions.
I think
what access are we looking for beyond that?
Yeah, I think that that's been our criticism is that if we are being told that certain questions are not appropriate at press conferences because the right people are not necessarily to everyone's liking that is being placed to answer these questions. You know, the Mark Shapiros are not doing these press conferences, Ari Emanuels, legal representatives for WWE. That is not specific to WWE. I think in many instances, like those people are not going to be your front facing people that are going to be speaking. I don't care what your relationship is with WWE. Those people are not going to be going on the record and speaking about this unless, you know, put in a position where, I mean, count the number of sit down interviews a Mark Shapiro does in a given year. And they're, you know, it's going to be a certain segment that he is speaking to. I can only speak for myself that I feel that having all I can say is that, like, the relationship with WWE, all I can ask for is the fact that whenever I have never been denied a credential that to a WWE event. There have been press conferences I've gone into, ones that I've not gotten into, but I don't look at it. I just look at it as a kind of subject reporter relationship that exists, and if you view us as just complaining all the time, that's your opinion to have.
Yeah, I mean, we're in touch with, you know, representatives from WWE's PR. I let them know sometimes when I come across nuisance lawsuits. I don't know if that matters to them. I met Nick Khan once, and we spoke off the record for like 5 minutes. Couple of years ago. That was before we reported the front office sports on the names of the people who are the anonymized corporate officers. So I don't know if he's my biggest fan anymore after that. But no, I think we reach out for a comment when it's appropriate to reach out for comment, and we ask questions that we think are appropriate to ask. And we've never gotten any pushback for that, by the way.
No, and I would just say that, like, for like all companies, like, I have open communications and channels in all the key companies. And when we do have stories to go through with WWE, I mean, typical, like if we need to get in touch with someone, they're usually someone's going to make time for us. If we press for it, it's not always going to be a given, but I mean, Brandon and I, like, there's plenty we speak to privately that, you know, we can have that communication, and at least all we want is, you know, we put something out that WWE side, they have the opportunity to respond. And if they don't, they don't, that's their prerogative. But it's, Brandon and I have a no surprises, doctrine that we like to, subscribe to, handed down to us from Tim Marchman. Don't leave any surprises.
Yes. Radiohead song too.
That's true. Yes. All right. Well, thank you for the question. And it's going to wrap up this week's edition of Pollock and Thurston. No guests this week, but we will see about next week, because next week we will be going into full gear, AEW's latest pay-per-view offering. So that is coming up in the just around the corner in New Jersey.
Say it again?
That's it. Full gear in New Jersey. I don't have much more to say about New Jersey other than
it's a pay-per-view. It's a show that is happening. There'll be matches, and it'll all be great matches, I bet, too.
Yeah, that's actually the title of the show. All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We are back every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. And coming up this Sunday, WrestleNomics Radio, patreon.com/WrestleNomics. You can send in your questions. Brandon@WrestleNomics.com. Wei Ting and I, we will be dropping a review of the 2009 film classic Death Warrior on Thursday, starring Quentin Rampage Jackson.
I saw the highlights, yeah.
one of the most horrendous movies I have ever seen in my life. That's going to be dropping on Thursday at postwrestlingcafe.com. And hey, Brandon and I up on Blue Sky. So go chat with us there. Unless that's not part of your silo that you want to see.
We'll be on X.com too.
We'll be on X as well. Yes. You can contact us, your social media platform of choice. We will be there for you. All right. That is it for us. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll speak with you next Wednesday.
This is the story of the one who, as a maintenance specialist for a historic high-rise, knows that vintage charm historically needs constant attention. Which is why, when it's time to upgrade turn-of-the-century mechanicals, they turn to Grainger. With easy access to a million-plus products and the scale to deliver when and where you need them, the right tools and supplies are never far away. So the one can keep that vintage building running like new. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.